Wow, what a beautiful morning, and I'm so thrilled to be here. Wowee. Yesterday we talked about the nature of what this is, that this is an illness, and it is an illness of the mind, and it is an illness of the body. That our minds work differently than the mind of a non-compulsive overeater. That there is a mental twist that occurs in me that does not occur in the normal temperate eater. The mental twist is something that in a very unnatural, very irresistible way will lock in on the sense of ease and comfort that comes about as the result of eating the food, and I will eat the food and for about 6 seconds or 8 seconds, I will get the effect of the food. I will get that sense of ease and comfort that comes instantaneously from eating the food. And a normal human being, a normal eater, 9 out of 10 people do not get that effect. They eat the food, it passes through them in a very natural way. They don't feel that sense of ease and comfort. And they also don't trigger the physical allergy. They don't trigger the craving. They don't trigger that craving which comes over me, and it does not come over the normal eater. And what we're going to be talking about this morning is another person who has this disease, who has this illness. And I know that there's medical people in here. So what this means when we say disease is something that separates me from the norm. If 9 out of 10 people react to food the way normal people do, and 1 out of 10 people reacts the way I do, I am considered to be in disease because I am separated from the norm. My reaction physically is allergic because the reaction is both adverse and abnormal. Adverse and abnormal is the definition of allergy. Okay? This morning, we're going to be talking about somebody who has this illness. And we're going to be talking, thinking, and reading about Bill Wilson this morning. And maybe what we're going to do is we're going to be able to sort of make this story a little less about Bill Wilson and hopefully a little bit more about you. And maybe you'll be able to see yourself. And maybe you'll be able to have some of the things that Bill thought and some of the things that Bill did identify with you and your story just a little bit. And we're also going to see the hand of God, not only on the pages of the book, but in the faces that I'm looking at this morning, because there is no way that this was put together by man. If you could see what I was seeing from up here, and if you could see what I was seeing, how special it is, you definitely know that this morning is a gift from God. It really, really is. Bill was 43 years old when the book was written. He had 3.5 years of sobriety. And I believe that God wrote this book for a lot of different reasons, but one of the reasons I most believe that God wrote this book is Bill Wilson, albeit he was a great man, he did not know enough to write one of the greatest pieces of spiritual literature that the world has ever seen. The book that he primarily authored, although there were other people who had input, and one of the chapters, Two Employers, was written by Hank P., he was the primary author of this fantastic, unbelievable, timeless piece of literature that will stand as one of the things that will be recognized by the 20th century philosophers, who said that the 20th century will ultimately be known most for man's flight, the entrance into the atomic age, and the development of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And as we move through the millennia, these three events will stand above the rest as the most memorable of the 20th century. Bill was born in East Dorset, Vermont. He was born in 1895, and without going into his whole biography, just very briefly to give you a little bit of an idea as to who he was born in 1895, and in 1906, his father and mother divorced. Now, today, divorce is almost mundane. It's almost like, oh, no big deal. But in 1906, divorce was quite scandalous. Just to put that in perspective for you, the grammar school that I went to in Chicago, we had three kids in that whole grammar school that were the products of divorce. And this was in the early 60s. Well, divorce in 1906 was quite scandalous. His mother went off to Boston, Massachusetts, and she became one of the nation's first osteopathic physicians. She went to Boston to study osteopathic medicine. His father went off to Western Canada and went off to the western, northwestern part of the United States to work in the quarries there. Vermont is very rich in granite, marble, and he was an expert in quarries. He also worked in the lumber trades out there. And Bill and Dorothy Wilson, Dorothy was Bill's younger sister, were raised by their grandma and grandpa Griffith. Those were his maternal grandparents. And we know that Bill's name was William G. Wilson. The G stands for Griffith. And Fayette Griffith raised Bill and Dorothy along with their grandmother in East Dorset, Vermont, in a rooming house slash tavern slash, you know, whatever. Today, it is a national monument in East Dorset, Vermont. His where he was raised is a national monument, and he's also buried there as well. Bill was a person who suffered from very grave depression. When he was 17 years old, he fell head over heels in love with a girl who went off to New York on a trip with her family and died. What they didn't know was she was going there also to get some treatment on things. She died. And Bill, when she died, Bertha died, he fell into a terrible, terrible depression. He also had a very strong yearning to prove to the world that he was important, that he had validity. He tried very, very hard to be somebody. He felt less than because all the other kids had a mom and a dad that loved him very much and that stayed together, and he blamed himself quite a bit, as a lot of kids do, for the divorce of his mother and his father. And Bill had a lot of depression and a lot of disappointment in his life, as we all did, but he was a very hard worker, very hard worker. He read somewhere that only an Aborigine could build a boomerang that would actually go and come back to you, and he worked in his grandfather's woodworking shop in the back, and he actually made a boomerang that actually did come back, and he worked and he worked. The only problem was is that on its trip back, it almost killed his grandfather. It just missed hitting him in the head. Yeah, so he was a very, very hard worker, and he set out to prove to the world that he was somebody. And of course, we know how God, you know, made that happen. Okay, we're on page one, and we're on Bill's story if you want to follow along. War fever ran high, and oh, wait, one other thing. Bill's story, as we're going to find out, is divided into two very distinct parts. The first eight pages are about Bill's plunge into the nadir of his alcoholism, and the second eight pages are about his recovery therefrom, and we'll kind of get into this, and we're going to see some things, and we're going to conceptualize some things today that are truly, truly God's work. Is it odd or is it God? I believe it's God. Okay. War fever ran high in the New England town to which we new young officers from Plattsburgh were assigned. We were flattered when the first citizens took us to their homes, making us feel heroic. Here was love, applause, war, moments sublime with intervals hilarious. I was part of life at last, and in the midst of the excitement, I discovered liquor. I forgot the strong warnings and prejudices of my people concerning drink. In time, we sailed for over there. And this is World War I. I was very lonely and again turned to alcohol. We landed in England. I visited Winchester Cathedral, much moved. I wandered outside. My attention was caught by a doggerel on an old tombstone. Here lies a Hampshire grenadier who caught his death drinking cold, small beer. A good soldier is ne'er forgot. whether he dieth by musket or by pot. Now, the pot that he's talking about here is not marijuana. He is talking about beer, and the way that they drank beer in England in those days was in they drank it in pint and quart pots. And those pints and quart pots were pot, that's what he's talking about. And the pints and quarts, you didn't sit and drink. It was considered extremely bad manners to sit and consume alcohol. You stood, and in as a way of making that a little bit easier, they would install a bar that the boys could lean against while they were drinking, hence the term bar. That's why we call it that today. And as they would start drinking, if they get a little rowdy, then the barkeeper would say, hey, watch your pints and quarts over there. And when that expression came to the colonies, it became watch your P's and Q's. And that's where that expression comes into our language today, is through the English. And even today, as an homage to the fact that you stood and drank, if you go to any bar and you see a bar stool, it is never level. It is always raised. Bar stools are always high as an homage to that old way of drinking and standing, not sitting and drinking. So that's sort of how that came into us today. See, we give you etymology, we give you history, we give you, we don't just give you away, we give you the whole Megillah here. Okay. The Yiddish word of the day is not Megillah. I have others coming. Okay. All right. Ominous warning which I failed to heed. 22 and a veteran of foreign wars, I went home at last. I fancied myself a leader, for had not the men of my battery given me a special token of appreciation. My talent for leadership, I imagine, would place me at the head of vast enterprises, which I would manage with utmost assurance. Not yet, but wait. I took a law course and obtained employment as investigator for a surety company. The drive for success was on. I proved to the world I was important. My work took me about Wall Street, and little by little I became interested in the market. Many people lost money, but some became very rich. Why not I? I studied economics and business as well as law. Potential alcoholic that I was, I nearly failed my law course. At one of the finals, I was too drunk to think or write. Though my drinking was not yet continuous, it disturbed my wife. We had long talks when I would still her forebodings by telling her that men of genius conceive their best projects when drunk, that the most majestic constructions of philosophic thought were so derived. Let's take that apart just a little bit before we move on. Number one, he nearly failed his law course because he was too drunk to think or write. So let's look at what was going on in his life, and I bet he's not the only one. The alcohol was beginning to shut doors in his face. The alcohol was making him do things that it wanted him to do. The alcohol was controlling him. He couldn't pass his test. He couldn't think. He couldn't write, because alcohol in his life at this time, like food in my life at a very early age, was controlling him. It was defining him. It was taking his little life, and it was making him who it wanted him to be. It said, no, little boy, you can't be a lawyer. No, little boy, you can't close your little league uniform. You don't get to go to homecoming. You don't get to go to the prom. You do get to wear snazzy socks, but you don't get to do those things because I said no. And you're going to eat M&Ms and like it. And Bill was too drunk to think or write. Now, let's look at the rest of the paragraph. He's fighting with Lois about his drinking, and he's lying to Lois. What's the first victim of compulsive overeating, alcoholism, drug addiction? The first thing that happens is truth goes right out the window. The very first casualty of compulsive behavior is the truth. And he's fighting, and he loves Lois, and Lois loves him. She dedicated her life to him, and he to her in many ways. So the bottom line is they're fighting, and he's not going to be a lawyer. Why? Because he is under the whip of his master, alcohol. So let's see where he goes from there. Okay? By the time I completed the course, I knew the law was not for me. The inviting maelstrom of Wall Street had me in its grip. Business and financial leaders were my heroes. Out of this alloy of drink and speculation, I commenced to forge the weapon that one day would turn in its flight like a boomerang, there's that word, and all but cut me to ribbons. Living modestly, my wife and I saved $1,000. Now, you may be thinking $1,000, not a lot of money. Go back to 1919, 1920, 1921. $1,000 is a lot of money, guys. $1,000, you could buy a lot of stuff for that. My God, that's a lot of money. It went into certain securities then cheap and rather unpopular. I rightly imagined that they would someday have a great rise. I failed to persuade my broker friends to send me out looking over factories and management, but my wife and I decided to go anyway. I had developed a theory that most people lost money in stocks through ignorance of markets. I discovered many more reasons later on. Bill is working on Wall Street, and he's not really a stockbroker. Okay, I got to tell you that he's not. What he is a New York City stock speculator who makes his living formulating opinions about what stock will yield a good profit and putting together people to buy in a group so that they can make money. And based on his advice, based on his opinion, these people are buying the stock, cutting him in on the profits, and he's not risking his own money. They're putting together buying combinations. But it's very much like if you went back to about 2005, 2006, you could pretty much, in those days, 1919, 1920, 21, you could pretty much have a monkey throw a dart at the dartboard at that time and hit a stock and say, okay, that one, on about a 10% margin, buy that stock, you were pretty much going to make money. I mean, you didn't need to be a genius. So Bill formulates this opinion that says, I think we're crazy. We need more information. We are making these judgments based on fresh air and sunshine, and it's just not right. We need more information. So they push back on him and say, oh, Bill, that's ridiculous. This is nuts. Well, he was cunning, baffling, and powerful, too. Let's see where he goes with cunning, baffling, powerful. We gave up our positions, and off we roared on a motorcycle, the sidecar stuffed with tent blankets, a change of clothes, three huge volumes of a financial reference service. Our friends thought a lunacy commission should be appointed. Perhaps they were right. I had had some success at speculation, so we had a little money. We once worked on a farm for a month to avoid drawing on our small capital. That was the last honest manual labor on my part for many a day. We covered the whole eastern United States in a year. At the end of it, my reports to Wall Street procured me a position there in the use of a large expense account. The exercise of an option brought in more money, leaving us with a profit of several thousand dollars for that year. If you were so inclined, go on Google and look up Chicago prices 1921, 1922. You could buy a car for a few $100. You could buy a house for a couple of $1,000. If you were a surgeon in Chicago in the early 20s, you might make a couple of $1,000 for the year. If you were an average working person, let's say you just drove a streetcar, you drove a bus in Chicago, or you worked as a most, you know, blue collar kind of thing, you might have made $35-$40 a week. And at $35-$40 a week, you were doing okay. You were doing just fine. He's making several thousand dollars for the year. And if you're also so inclined, there's many, many pictures of Bill with the motorcycle and Lois in the motorcycle. And, you know, you can look that up. And they're quite comical, you know, driving around and camping. But they did it. And then he starts sending these reports back to Wall Street. And they start realizing, hey, he was right. We really do need this information. And they got excited about it. And things are going well for Bill Wilson. He is on the upswing right now. Things are going well. His opinion matters. He's rubbing elbows. Let's see where he goes. For the next few years, fortune threw money and applause my way. I had arrived. Okay. My judgment and ideas were followed by many to the tune of paper millions. Just think about that. Your opinion and many are investing in the millions. Could you just, and this is when millions was a lot of money. Looking at the prices here, my God, you guys spend a million every time you go to the grocery store. All right, anyway, bottom line is that look at that and think about what that would do for you. Just because you say so, just because you think so, just because you believe it, that's good enough for these people, not just to slap you on the back, but to put up millions of dollars. Can you imagine what that would do for your ego? My God. Let's see where he goes from there. The great boom of the late 20s was seething and swelling. Drink was taking an important and exhilarating part in my life. There was loud talk in the jazz places uptown. Everyone spent in thousands and chattered in millions. Scoffers could scoff and be damned. I made a host of fair weather friends. Everybody wants to be Bill Wilson's friend to find out where the market's going next. He's got fair weather friends in much the same way that if Bill Gates came in here or some of these other big tycoons or movie stars or TV stars came in here, you'd want to buddy up to them too because they're successful and people are buddying up to Bill Wilson. And everything he had ever wanted was right there for him. This is what he dreamed about when he was a little boy growing up in East Dorset, Vermont. Let's see where alcohol takes him. Now, in one sentence, my drinking assumed more serious proportions, continuing all day and almost every night. The remonstrances of my friends terminated in a row, and I became a lone wolf. So, the remonstrances of my friends means they're getting on him about his drinking. You know, yeah, we're making money, but look at you. You're laying on the floor drunk. Bill was a fall-down, gutter drunk. He was a very, very low-bottom drunk. And it's terminating in a row means that he's having arguments with these people and things are starting to blow up on him. And in one sentence, he became a lone wolf. I bet I'm not the only person in this room who wanted to be part of the crowd, who wanted to go to the event, who wanted to attend the event and stayed home with little Debbie. I'm not the only person in this room who just wanted to be part of that crowd. They looked outside and there was life and there were people and there were things going on, but I'm going to stay here with Raisinets because after I finish these Raisinets, I'm not going to eat Raisinets anymore. I'm going to lose weight and I'm going to be part of that group, but for right now, I'm just going to kind of stay here and eat Milk Duds. Am I the only person in this room that ever did that? I bet I'm not, judging by what I see in your eyes. So everything I ever wanted was out there and everything I ever hated was in here, but I'm going to stay in here with Sara Lee. And that was my life. And that is his life. And he sees these people and they're evaporating. And rather than plug the jug, he says, who the F needs them? They can all go shut the front door. Who needs them? We don't care. And he's miserable. My drinking assumed more serious proportions, continuing all day and almost every night. The remonstrances of my friends terminated in a row and I became a lone wolf. There were many unhappy scenes in our sumptuous apartment. There had been no real infidelity, for loyalty to my wife, helped at times by extreme drunkenness, kept me out of those scrapes. Maybe. In 1929, I contracted golf fever. We went at once to the country, my wife to applaud, while I started out to overtake Walter Hagen. Walter Hagen would be like Tiger Woods now or something like that. Okay. Liquor caught up with me much faster than I came up behind Walter. I began to be jittery in the morning. Golf permitted drinking every day and every night. It was fun to carom around the exclusive course, which had inspired such awe in me as a lad. I acquired the impeccable coat of tan one sees upon the well-to-do. The local banker watched me whirl fat checks in and out of his till with amused skepticism. So Lois and Bill are trying geographic cures. Some of you may have come up here to Alaska looking for a geographic cure. We run into them all the time in Arizona. There should be, in every state, a sign. You know, where, like, if you go to the Wisconsin-Illinois border, it says, you are now leaving Illinois, and then, like, in another, like, 5 minutes, it'll say, Wisconsin welcomes you. And then when you go the other way, it says, you're leaving Wisconsin, and it says, Illinois welcomes you. My dad, by the way, I don't want to get too far off here, he thought that was amazing. No guards, no fence. You could just go from Wisconsin to Illinois and Illinois to Wisconsin, and you didn't need papers. You didn't need, like, anything. You could just, like, do that all day. Like, that could be your day. You could just do that. He was amazed. He couldn't get over that. He could not get over, you can just go to Wisconsin? You don't need papers? He couldn't believe it. It was like a shock. You know what else really shocked him? He couldn't believe that one person leaves office and one person goes into the office and there's not a shot fired and no one died. He couldn't believe such a thing was possible. He was amazed by these things. But anyway, why am I? Oh, I'll tell you. See, I get too, you got to hold me to my fire here, especially in the morning when I'm all full of coffee and everything. Okay. Why is my dad in Wisconsin being discussed? Oh, because he did the geographic tour. Okay, there should be a sign on every state when it says Arizona welcomes you. We don't work either. Keep going. We can't help you here. Keep going. There's California. There's New Mexico, Utah, Nevada. Just keep going. Then you can get to California and say, well, this doesn't work either. Keep going. There's the ocean. Just keep going. It doesn't work. Wherever you go, there you are. It doesn't work. Some of you may have come up here looking for that magic state, that magic place to live where everything would be just perfect. And I know that in Arizona we run into that a lot. Oh, boy. And in Chicago, too. Okay. You got to shut me up sometimes. Just tell me quiet. That's enough. Okay. Abruptly in October 1929, what? Well, oh, that. Yeah. One compulsive overeater telling another compulsive overeater what to do, and I'm encouraging that. Okay. Abruptly in October 1929, hell broke loose on the New York Stock Exchange. After one of those days of inferno, I wobbled from a hotel bar to a brokerage office. It was 8 o'clock, 5 hours after the market closed. The ticker still clattered. I was staring at an inch of tape which bore the inscription XYZ32. It was really Penick and Ford that they were looking at, but okay. It had been 52 that morning. I was finished, and so were many friends. The papers reported men jumping to death from the towers of high finance. That disgusted me. I would not jump. I went back to the bar. Now, let's take a look at this, because we're going to refer back to his thoughts of suicide. He is looking at these men who are committing suicide, and they are going up to the towers of high finance. The Prudential Building, when I was a little boy, is 32 stories. Now it looks like one of the gift shops at the Hancock Building. But when I was a little boy, the Prudential Building was the biggest building in Chicago, and when we used to watch TV and radio, they'd say, broadcasting live from the top of the Prudential Building, right? You grew up in Palatine, okay. So, they say broadcasting live from the top of the... Well, why were these guys killing themselves? Their God was dead. Their God was dead. Their God was money. Their God was the stock market. Their God had just died. So they went up and they killed themselves. What did Bill know but not know? He knew it but not intellectually. That his God was at the bar. That he could feel better because unbeknownst to him, without being really conscious of it, he knew that if he went down there, he would find other people to get drunk with. And in getting drunk with these people, that alcohol would rekindle his optimism about tomorrow, because he knew the effect. What he also did not know is he was going to trigger by drinking the allergy. He doesn't know about that, and even knowing about it isn't going to stop it. We know about it. That's not going to cure us, okay? Self-knowledge is not going to help us here. But, so he goes back to the bar, and make mental note of how he's looking down on these people that want to kill themselves, because we're going to refer to that a couple more times this morning, okay? That disgusted me. I would not jump. I went back to the bar. My friends had dropped several million since 10 o'clock. So what? Tomorrow was another day. As I drank, the old fierce determination to win came back. Raisinettes makes me feel like if I eat a few raisinettes, I'll never eat raisinettes again. Now, if that ain't crazy, I don't know what is. If that's not a form of insanity, then somebody, when we're on break, tell me what that is. I would never, ever take my head and put it in a vise and keep tightening the vise, thinking that if I tighten it just enough, that it will cure my headache. I would never think that. But that's exactly what I did with food. That is exactly what I did with food. Okay. Next morning, I telephoned a friend in Montreal. That would be his friend, Dick Johnson. He had plenty of money left and thought I had better go to Canada. And Dick tried to employ Bill. Dick Johnson had a lot of respect for Bill. He really loved him, but let's see where it goes from here. By the following spring, we were living in our accustomed style. I felt like Napoleon returning from Elba. No St. Helena for me, but drinking caught up with me again, and my generous friend had to let me go. This time, we stayed broke. We went to live with my wife's parents. I found a job and lost it as a result of a brawl with a taxi driver. Now, let's take that sentence and understand that the world that you live in here in 2012 is a very different world than the world that the Wilsons are living in at the end of 1929. And 1930. As a man, as a little boy, we're told girls may like you, but they will not starve to death for you. We're told that your job is to put a roof over her head. We're told that your job is to put food on the table. We're told that you better take her on vacations. We're told she needs a car to drive. We're told these things because they're true. And that's passed from one generation to the other. And every boss I ever had, every parent of other kids I ever had said the same exact things to me, that they will like you, they won't if you're fat, that proved to be true, but they will not starve to death for you. You better be prepared to go out there and make a living. Okay, that's what we're told. So, now they're moving back with his wife's parents. The world that he's living in is a world where men had a different role than they have today. Women had a different role than they have today. And he has failed in his ability to take care of his precious Lois. He has failed to put a roof over her head. And he feels like garbage. I found a job and lost it as the result of a brawl with a taxi driver. Mercifully, no one could guess I was to have no real employment for 5 years or hardly draw a sober breath. My wife began to work in a department store, coming home exhausted to find me drunk. You think after she stood on her feet at Lowe's department store making $19 a week, she comes home and Yutso is on the couch dead drunk. You think they may have had a few arguments about that? You think they may have had a few loud discussions about that? I sure think so. I became an unwelcome hang-around at brokerage places. Liquor ceased to be a luxury. It became a necessity. Stop right there. Liquor ceased to be a luxury. It became a necessity. I don't know about you. I know about me. When I was a little boy, I overate every day. As a bigger boy and a fatter boy and an older boy, I overate more and more every day and overate more and more every day and overate more and more every day. Liquor ceased to be a luxury. It became a necessity. When I go out of town and I come here to Anchorage, and I've been very lucky to have traveled this country in service to OA, I have to do a lot of prayer and meditation. Because I have always wanted to see Alaska. I've always wanted to be here. I've always wanted to do what I did this morning, and that is wake up and see Mount McKinley and see Green and be able to say I've been to Alaska. Pretty cool, huh? Mm-hmm. I never really went anywhere as a kid, and look at where God has taken me. Look at the people that he's had me meet, and look at the places that he's had me see. And sometimes I get up in the morning and I look in around Scottsdale, Arizona, and Scottsdale is gorgeous. I mean, it really is. Not so much the next few months, whew, but it is really, Arizona is beautiful, and there's different parts to Arizona. Not every part of Arizona is like the part I live in. I can go up to Prescott, and I can go up to Flagstaff, and I can go over to, you know, places where it looks very similar to this, very, very similar to the greenery that you see around you. Northern Arizona is very, very reminiscent of this, very mountainy and very like this. What a blessing. But you know, it's funny, as much as I want to do those things and see those things, when I come here, what's in the back of my mind? What am I going to eat? How am I going to function? You know, what kind of food are they going to have? And where am I staying? And what, you know, what's this? And tomorrow night, it's like squirrely because normally I go back home on Sunday, but I can't get a flight till like 1 a.m. Monday. And I'm like, whoa. And I just have to, and my sponsor says, God didn't take you this far to drop you in Lake Michigan now. You're going to be fine. And I say that to my sponsor, God didn't take us this far to drop us in Lake Michigan. And so far, I've been here since Thursday, and I haven't starved to death yet. And I got Diet Pepsi, and I got coffee, and I got water, and I got everything I need, and a bed to sleep in, and all this other stuff. And everything is, and I got Schnazzy new socks, and I got everything. So everything is really pretty cool, and it's going to be fine. And it is fine, and it's going to be even finer. It's fine. Well, the reason I bring that up is, that food part of it, not being that luxury, not being that necessity, can drive a person into a lot of different forms of insanity. Let's see where he goes from there. Bathtub gin, 2 bottles a day, often 3. See, sometimes you just got to tell me, shut up, Daddy. Okay, got to be a routine. Sometimes a small deal would net a few $100s, and I would pay my bills at the bars and delicatessens. This went on endlessly, and I began to waken very early in the morning, shaking violently. A tumbler full of gin followed by 6 bottles of beer would be required if I were to eat any breakfast. Nevertheless, I thought I could still control the situation, and there were periods of sobriety which renewed my wife's hope. So what's Bill doing there? He's dieting. Thank you. He is going on a diet. He is dieting. And he's doing the very same things that we have done. He went on a diet, and he is trying to control his drinking on his own unaided willpower. And that's not going to work, is it? You looked at the teacher's edition. Okay. Now he's dieting. Okay. Gradually, things got worse. The house was taken over by the mortgage holder. My mother-in-law died. My wife and father-in-law became very ill. Then I got a promising business opportunity. Stocks were at a low point of 1932, and I had somehow formed a group to buy. Sorry. I was to share generously in the profits. Then I went on a prodigious bender, and the chance vanished. This is a story within the story. These guys were from Cherry Hill, New Jersey. Cherry Hill, New Jersey people came to him when he was on one of his
diet,
and they came over to him when he was on one of his diets, and they said, we've got this purchase that we want to make, and we know you're very good, and we want you to be in charge of this, but what's going on with your drinking, because we're hearing some pretty wacky stuff. And he says, no, I'm on a diet. No, he says, I've given up liquor, because he doesn't know he's on a diet, right? And he says to them, no, you don't have to worry about me drinking. So they schedule a meeting in a hotel room in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. And this was in the days of Prohibition. And these guys are passing around a bottle of Applejack whiskey called Jersey Lightning. And they're passing around this Jersey Lightning, this Applejack Jersey Lightning. And the jug comes around, and Bill says, I'm not drinking. Jug comes around, I'm not drinking, and finally somebody nudges him, because these guys are getting a little drunk too. Finally somebody nudges him and says, hey, Wilson, come on, you can have one drink. Now remember, nobody in that room knew the first thing about alcoholism. You can have one drink. I made this myself. Well, figuring he's never had any Jersey Lightning, he takes a swig out of the jug, and for 3 days he was in that hotel room drunk on the floor because he triggered the physical allergy. And no matter how long it had been since he had had a drink, it doesn't matter whether it's 10 minutes or 10,000 years, he has the physical allergy. Allergies are immutable. You're born with them, you die with them. That is not the treatable part of the illness. We're going to get to that a little later. But allergies, they can treat the symptoms. When I call up my doctor, I'm Scott Stanley Shea, and I say to my doctor, man, I am dying here from hay fever. You want to talk about allergies being in Arizona? Whoa, man. And I have to, he gives me pills that treat the symptoms. There is nothing that he can do about the hay fever. Nothing. He can treat the symptoms. He gives me a pill that stops the flow of yicky, sticky stuff. But that's about all he can do, is stop the yucky stuff. Okay. I woke up. This had to be stopped. I saw I could not take as much as one drink. I was through forever. He's back on his. There you go. I was through forever. Before then, I had written lots of sweet promises, but my wife happily observed, this time I meant business, and so did I did. So Lois is all excited. He finally gets it. He finally understands he can't drink like that. I'm so proud of him, and look at him. He's gone 15 minutes without a drink. Okay, shortly afterward, I came home drunk. There had been no fight. Where had been my high resolve? I simply didn't know. It hadn't even come to mind. Someone had pushed a drink my way. I had taken it. Was I crazy? I began to wonder, for such an appalling lack of perspective seemed near being just that. Renewing my resolve, going back on my diet, thank you, I tried again. Some time passed and confidence began to be replaced by cocksuredness. I could laugh at the Raisinette factories, the gin mills. Now I had what it takes. One day I walked into a cafe to telephone. In no time, I was beating on the bar, asking myself how it happened. As the whiskey rose to my head, I told myself I would manage better next time, but I might as well get good and drunk then. And I did. I'm going to make sure that I eat all the pizza in the refrigerator, so that tomorrow, when I'm really on my diet, there won't be any pizza in here to tempt me. And about the second piece of pizza in, I'm calling for another one, because I want to get this Luigi thing out of my system, or this Gino's East thing out of my system. And then I'm going to start on the Raisinets, and then I'm going to clean out the cabinet, because I think there's some cookies in here. Yeah, here they are. There's some cookies in here somewhere, and I'm going to make sure I do everything to get this stuff out of the cabinet, because tomorrow I'm really going on my diet. Anybody else ever experience anything like that? I thought so. Okay. The remorse, horror, and hopelessness of the next morning are unforgettable. The courage to do battle was not there. My brain raced uncontrollably, and there was a terrible sense of impending calamity. I hardly dare cross the street lest I collapse and be run down by an early morning truck, for it was scarcely daylight. An all-night place supplied me with a dozen glasses of ale. My writhing nerves were stilled at last. A morning paper told me the market had gone to hell again. So had I. The market would recover, but I wouldn't. That was a hard thought. Should I kill myself? So here we go. He was looking down his nose at the imbeciles going up to the building and killing themselves. And what's he thinking now? He's going to kill himself, because there's just, it's death by Dorito just ain't working. You know, it's just not working.